By now, you'll have heard or seen that I'm working with a new golf app called Tangent, who are also sponsoring this show. It's the smartest AI caddy in golf and is able to recommend not only clubs to hit, but target locations based on the math behind strokes gained and your own personal shot patterns. Unlike many other shot trackers, it also takes into account and adjusts for hazards that are out there. It has sensorless tracking with an amazing automatic swing detection that you can use with your Apple Watch or your phone without any need to buy any attachments for your clubs. And my favorite part, the post-round analysis data helps you immediately see where you can improve and gives you simple breakdowns that you can dive into if you want much more detail about your stats. It then links this data to recommendations and actual practice drills that you can use to improve. Getting measurable data for both on-course and practice drills makes Tangent one of the best game improvement ecosystems that I've ever seen. So download Tangent for free on the Apple App Store or at tangent.golf and use promo code SWEET30, that's SWEET30, for 30% off. So you'll get a free trial, and if you like it and want to continue, it'll give you 30% off a subscription. So just try it out, play a few rounds with it, and I know you'll love it. So that's Tangent, T-A-N-G-E-N-T, and enter code SWEET30.
Welcome back to another episode of The Sweet Spot. This is John Sherman from Practical Golf, and as always, I'm joined by
Adam from Adamian Golf.
Today, we are joined by Sweet Spot friend, Andrew Rice. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, gents. I appreciate the invite to come back on. Always a fun banter session.
Yeah, you know, we've been going back. Time flies, obviously. And yeah, I've been going back on the catalog and seeing like, well, who have we had on that we want to have on again? It's been almost 2 years since you were on the show with us. We figured that you were, yeah, it's crazy. 2021. Yeah. I think it's kind of a shock to me that this show has been around that long, but it has. If people have gone back in the catalog, we did do an episode on wedges with Andrew, but Andrew knows a lot more than just wedges. So we figured we'll go into some different topics. Maybe we will get back into wedges. But yeah, Andrew Rice, for those of you who don't know, he's widely regarded. You're on like every top 50, whatever lists that all the publications come out. He's a highly decorated coach. He's someone I've learned a lot from. I know Adam respects him as well. So
for sure, guys, I just wanted to start out by saying you've been kind enough to share top 50 this, top 50 that, but I wanted to congratulate you guys. And this is kind of a cool thing. So many of my students, we have a little interview before the start of any lesson that they come to, and they go, you know, yeah, I've been really listening to The Sweet Spot. I've been checking out Adam Young Practice Plan. I've been reading John Sherman. And so congrats to you guys. I'm starting to hear your names. I'm starting to hear the content about the content that you're putting out there. It's really good. It's working. Keep it up.
Thank you. It's nice to, we start to find more and more Sweet Spot listeners as we go out there. I was at a golf tournament recently, walking around following a player. A FedEx event, and someone came up to me. They're like, John Sherman. I'm like, yes. And it was a Sweet Spot listener. So it's very cool. You know, we've got so many listeners from around the world, huge supporters. So yeah, it's been very cool. That's great to hear that you're seeing some of your students listening to the show.
I'm the opposite. Whenever I go out, I go out and play golf all the time with random people. I'll turn up if I have a few hours spare. I'll say, right, I'll just go out and play golf and just join up with whoever's there, because I kind of find it fun to just meet new people, listen to their stories. And inevitably, at some point, they ask me, what do I do for a living? And I tell them, and no one's ever heard of me.
Who the hell are you?
Actually, I've had one guy, 2 or 3 years ago. So yeah, that was the highlight of my year when he said, I know who you are.
We're famous, but we're not that famous. Let's put it that way.
Famous in our own heads. Yeah.
Yeah. Andrew, you've done you've been sharing content online for a really long time. I would say you're one of the OGs of the online golf content space. And so you've been sharing a lot of great research and stuff I've cited in the book. One thing I want to start off with is you've done a ton of work on wind.
Yes, over the last couple of years.
And you've done some testing on your own. I know you've collaborated with the Ping guys, and we've had Chris Brody and Marty Jurchen on the show, and we discussed it not entirely, we touched on Win, but I think, you know, we talk about course management and strategy on the show a lot and how we can save golfers strokes without changing their golf swing through their decision-making.
I love that.
One thing that I, over the years, have had to learn the hard way playing in wind all the time is how to adjust. And you've put out some great information. I cited some of it in my book. So I want to talk about the wind because I don't think it's something a lot of golfers adjust properly and they're just throwing away strokes left and right. So let's start touching on that first.
Would love to, John. Firstly, golf is an outdoor sport and we would like for the weather to be calm, 75 degrees, lovely every day, no clouds, no wind. But the reality is it's different almost every day that we play. And we've got to be equipped as golfers to be able to deal with the different challenges, be it temperature, wind, elevation. We've got to have some idea as to how those factors are going to influence the flight, the journey of our golf ball. And with the help of Chris Brody primarily, Eric has helped a lot too, but primarily Chris over at Ping, he's shared some great information and he's got the information and I try to package it in a fashion whereby everyday golfers can remember it and perhaps use it and apply it to their games and start to save some strokes. And so what we found, there was some commotion on Twitter a couple of months ago when I first put out my most recent formula in that I don't think I did a good job in stating who the most recent information was angled towards. And I would say this latest formula that I've got is directed towards the everyday golfer. What does that mean? If you have a driver club head speed of somewhere between 78 miles an hour and 95 miles an hour, and I would say the vast majority, certainly of male golfers out there, are going to slot into that bucket. That's a big bucket, 78 to 95. And if you feel that, and I know so many guys say, well, I swing it at 105, and they don't really, but let's just go with those numbers. Those are real numbers.
The Twitter golfer does.
There's a few. If you swing the driver in that range, let's understand that if you have higher club head speed, you are A, going to hit the ball longer, but you're also B, going to hit the ball higher. And anytime you hit the ball higher, the effect of wind will be greater, whether it's hurting or helping. And so a little formula that Chris helped me come up with is as follows. For the 78 mph to 95 mph crowd, if you've got 10 miles an hour of wind blowing in your face and you've got a 150-yard shot, the shot is going to play 10 yards longer. So 10 mph headwind equates to 10 yards. 20 mph headwind equates to 20 yards. Is this true for players that swing faster than 95 miles an hour? No. The wind is going to affect their ball more than these regular speed, I'll call it, golfers. And so let's understand 5, 10, 15, or 20. I encourage all my golfers, I've got a wind meter that I carry around with me on the golf course in my golf bag. And anytime we're out on the golf course and we're playing a few holes with some students, I'll pull it out and say, okay, everybody, how much wind is blowing right now? And invariably, the majority of golfers will go 25, 18, and it's blowing 11.
Yeah, would you say most people overestimate the speed of the wind? Yeah, that would make sense to me.
I've found a way to get it correct. Weather.com.
Yeah, there's this crazy thing where you go and check the
Wonderground,
forecast, right?
com. Check the weather app on your phone. Those things are pretty good. I've on a number of occasions, I'll check what the wind speed is predicted on the weather app. I'll pull out my wind meter, hold it up there for 30 seconds, get an average, and it's always pretty close. But invariably, most golfers will overestimate the mph of the wind. Airline pilots don't, thankfully. But most golfers will overestimate the mph of the wind. And once you've got a sense as to, I've got this wind straight into my face and it said it's blowing 10. So that's 10 mph is 10 yards. Headwinds. Okay. Faster club head speeds are going to have greater effect for the wind. And now it almost, if you get above 110, it gets to a point where it's almost now a percentage 10 mph of wind in your face becomes closer to 10% of the distance.
My assumption is for the higher swing speed player is that they're launching it higher with more spin.
Typically, they'll launch it at the same or lower, but because it continues, they have so much ball speed, John, that the ball might launch the same or lower, but it pulls away from gravity for so long and it spends such a long time in the air, it reaches a higher peak height. I know TrackMan put out a chart almost 15 years ago now, and PGA Tour average height was 90 feet. LPGA Tour average height with all clubs was 75 feet. And that seems to run true across the board. If your club speed, this is interesting, if your club speed is 78 mph or less, the effect of the wind on your shots is negligible.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Which I thought was very interesting. And that was something that Chris shared with me. If you swing the driver at 70 miles an hour, the wind's not going to affect your ball very much at all, either helping or hurting.
Can you convert that to just so listeners who don't have access to like a swing speed monitor or launch monitor, like what would be a typical drive for someone at 70 miles an hour?
Okay. So that would, you're testing my, you got to remember I went to UCF, John. Okay. You're testing my math here. But if somebody swings,
that'd be a sub 200 yard drive, I'm
correct.
Assuming.
If you use a driver and you hit it less than 200 yards, the wind is really going to have very little effect on your 8-iron, your driver, headwind, or tailwind.
They're just not getting the ball high enough in the air for it.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Well said. Yeah. Well said.
That's interesting. We had them on and we never got into this where there's subsets of golfers. Obviously, the bucket that you described, the 78 to 95 mile per hour, that's obviously the biggest bucket. But then you have high swing speed players who have to take into account more for wind and then low. To go even further, would you say, so my driver swing speed is like 108. But yes. I'm a very low spin player. And I think one of my advantages in the wind is that, you know, I'm only spinning my 7-iron, I don't know, 4,500, like danger territory. One of my strengths is that I can get my ball through the wind compared to someone who's probably spinning at 6,500. So, you know, what's your advice to, I guess I'm trying to figure out what's the best way to customize all this information to, you know, everyone always asks the question, well, what do I do personally?
I would say this, and certainly, you know, we've got to, trying to come up with a wind formula must be a rule of thumb because wind doesn't blow constantly at 10 miles an hour and it doesn't blow constantly from one direction. An interesting test the Ping guys ran, and they said if the speed of the wind varies by, I think it was 15% up and down randomly, and the direction of the wind varies by 15 degrees left and 15 degrees right randomly, what do we do if we take a plotting of shots and put that and expose that to that wind? What happens to the dispersion? And the dispersion actually increases by 30% when we add that randomness to the wind, which I think is very interesting. And I've said this for a long time. I think the greatest obstacle, the greatest challenge, hazard in golf is wind. And ideally, it would be a wind in your face. If I've got a student and they can pull out a 6-iron or a 5-iron and they can make it go the appropriate distance on the appropriate line into a 15-mile-an-hour wind, they're in good shape.
Yeah, I view it as I play in the wind all the time. And I think it's the best quote-unquote training aid that exists. If you can hit good golf shots that go the intended distance and you have a reasonable dispersion into the wind, like, you know that you're a really good ball striker.
Yes.
And one of the things that I think a lot of golfers probably know this intuitively, but seeing, you know, the Ping research and our discussion is that hitting into the wind, as you said, increases dispersion left to right. Whereas hitting with a tailwind, it doesn't help as much as hitting into the wind hurts.
Correct.
And it also kind of knocks the ball down and tightens your dispersion a bit. So it's really hitting into the wind that is the true test of, I think, decision-making and ball striking.
Yes. And John, an interesting point. I know I've touched on headwinds. So 10 mph, if you fit into the 78 to 95 mile an hour bucket, 10 mph in your face is going to hurt you 10 yards. Tailwinds, helping wind straight behind you is going to be half of that. If you've got 10 mph blowing behind you, your ball is going to, and I'm going to say this very specifically, your ball's going to carry 5 yards only longer. It's not necessarily going to stop in the same amount of time. It's going to take longer to stop. You definitely will get additional rollout, but the carry distance, which we all need to pay more attention to instead of that total distance, the carry distance is going to increase typically by half the MPH of the wind for a tailwind.
Because it's knocking the ball down a bit.
It's knocking the ball down a bit. It's helping it, but it's all to do with the dynamics. The ball speed is going with the wind, and so there's not as much drag on the golf ball versus when it's going really into that wind, the drag really increases, and that shortens the shot.
You also mentioned, I know you're talking earlier about wind into the face, and you were talking about a random wind if it was changing a little bit. Mm. But with wind into the face, even if it's constant direction, constant speed, that still increases the dispersion because, I mean, it increases the effect of any spin axis tilt, any side spin, if you want to put it in simple terms. But also you're hitting longer clubs in. So, you know, any face error that you have with lower spin loft is going to be exaggerated more. So wind into the face really, really hurts us.
And we've all experienced this, guys, is you can miss that 7 iron a little bit when there's no wind, and it can still end up on the green and you can have that 20 footer. But when you're hitting that 7 iron, obviously from a lesser distance into the wind, and you miss it a little bit, you don't have a 20 footer. The quality of strike can really be exposed when it comes to headwind shots.
And I think a lot of golfers, I realize a lot of people listening to this play in areas that don't have a lot of wind. I'm thinking of like Arizona golfers, for example, like they just wouldn't have as much as someone where I live near the water. Certainly our listeners in Scotland or the UK or parts of Australia, we have golfers from all over the world. And some people don't deal with this, but I think when they get exposed to wind, they kind of fight against it and they don't accept that things are going to be a little bit more random. There's going to be a lot more out of your control. And some golfers will try and swing harder and do all these things. And my thought to them is like, well, I don't think a lot of golfers need a fancy punch shot. It's just selecting the appropriate club, and especially into a headwind, which has the most influence. I often tell people, you know what launches the ball lower with less spin? A longer club.
A lower club.
Yeah.
I'm like, if it's a 7 iron, you know, it's okay to take the 6 or 5 iron. Like that'll keep the ball lower with less spin. I mean,
and swinging more softly, you know, when it's breezy, swing easy.
Yeah.
I know this. Tom Watson was tremendously successful in the Open Championship, even though I do love to say the British Open. I think I'm going to say that. The British Open, he was very successful there, and he never looked like he hit knockdown shots. He looked like he hit every shot pretty much the same.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. My belief, and again, I can't account for every golfer, but I think for players who feel like they need to change something, whether that's shortening their swing, ball position, like the second they feel like they need to do something different and they haven't worked on it enough, I feel like the quality of their strike will suffer more than just saying like, well, I'll just take more club and not do anything special here. Like it's kind of like the path of least resistance to me.
Dance with who you brung.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, we watch TV and you see like guys like Tommy Fleetwood, and there's a lot of pro golfers that obviously Rory hitting that final shot was at the Scottish Open where he hit that two
that
iron. I mean, that was an iconic shot, but let's face it, most people don't have that. You know, they're not going to be able to change their flight and trajectory as much as they want. So I just find hitting into the wind is the harder test, and just choosing the appropriate club and not doing anything fancy is usually the best answer to me for most players.
Great advice.
Do you think there's any advantage to hitting punch shots then versus, so if you're going to hit a punchy 7 versus a normal 6, what's the advantage of the punch shot? Why do you think pros do it?
I would say this, Adam. They've practiced it first. They have experience. They've developed skill in playing that shot. And it's not something that they've decided to unveil in the middle of the 7th fairway, like, oh, I saw this on TV, let's try this for the first time. Yeah. That's something, you know, Tommy Fleetwood, we see him. I love that look. It's kind of a cool look when he hits that little knockdown style shot. Certainly, we've seen Tiger over the years hit a lot of stingers. It's a different type shot. They've practiced it. They know how the ball's going to react and how this amount of wind in their face, and there may or may not be wind, but this ball flight is going to respond. Whereas most of us, We just haven't got the time available to us to be able to go out and practice that one unique type shot. If you do, go practice it. Have some fun with it. You're going to become a better golfer for sure.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, I to be transparent with people, like I do have a wind punch shot because I play in the wind all the time. Like it's just a necessity for me. So I've worked on it. I've put a lot of time into it and it's nothing crazy different, but it's different. And you know, there's a difference in ball position, my follow through. It's still my swing, but I've put time into it over the years. Even a driver, I have a knockdown, like kind of low hook driver. Again, didn't just come off on the seventh fairway and think about doing it. So
what's the advantage of it? If the launch and the spin are very similar, they might not be, but what would be the advantage of the punch over just the easy five instead of a punchy six?
The only reason I'll use it is if I'm in extreme, like I sometimes play in excess of 20 mile per hour wind. When it gets crazy for me, that's when I'll know I need to keep it down. And also play on a golf course that has a ton of elevation changes. So I don't use it a lot, but I typically have found into the wind better results for myself. Just a minor adjustment that I've noticed, it doesn't go as far offline and I can keep my distances more.
John, I love that. Just to add on to the back of that, Adam, I like the question. Anytime I can keep the ball closer to the ground,
yeah,
I like that.
Lower.
I like that. Lower. Yeah.
Really, lower. All it is just more, I think it's just more shaft lean is what I'm doing. I'm just delivering a little more shaft lean and less lofted impact.
Ball back slightly narrower.
Without having to hit, again, if the difference between me hitting a 4-iron and 6-iron, I've, again, in my own testing and my own game, for the small amount of time that I do it, I've found better dispersion and distance control with doing that with like a 6-iron versus a 4-iron. Sometimes, again, in excessive, I don't do this often. And I'm just saying, like, it's something I've tested, I've worked on a lot, and I've noticed better results with it. Again, in very extreme conditions with elevation changes.
What I found personally is if you're hitting the punch 7 versus the smoother 6, you can increase the spin loft a little with the punchy 7. So you end up getting the same distance, but you got an increased spin loft. So that helps to tilt the spin axis more neutral. It can help keep it straighter, which is probably what you've been experiencing, John. You know, so you can get that lower launch angle, but a little bit more spin on it. So yeah, you end up getting that same distance, but with a little bit more accuracy. But obviously the big trade-off is, can you hit the shot? You know, like you said, if you're pulling it out, if you've never tried it before, it's going to be very, very difficult to understand how the path and the face are going to change with that.
No, I'm thinking back to, like, I once played a tournament in Bermuda. It was blowing in excess of 35 to 40 miles an hour. And I was hitting like driver, like low hook. I'm talking crazy stuff.
Yeah.
I always prefer simplicity, but it's interesting to me. Andrew, I do want to touch on more topics here with you because you have such a breadth of information. Is there anything else major on wind that you would like people to know? Because I think what you said on that new equation is very handy.
John, I would say this. If you're playing in high winds, and I would qualify high winds as 20 plus, your weather app is going to tell you, it's invariably going to show that little cloud with a line through it, blowing wind or some kind of hurricane flag if it's 20 plus. Oftentimes, golfers will come in from the golf course and say, it was blowing 50 out there. If it's blowing 50 out there, I'm sorry, you're not standing up.
You can't play.
You cannot play. The highest I've played in and measured, I got my wind meter to 36 miles an hour at Port Rush one day. And it was a case of, if you took a stand bag and you stood it up in the fairway, it would get blown over and then try to keep rolling. And that was at 36. Okay.
I have a video from Port Royal in Bermuda where the pin was actually touching the ground.
Wow.
They kept us going. We wanted to finish the tournament and I shot a 78. It might have been the best round of my life.
That is amazing.
I literally, you know the 16th at Port Royal on the water? It's on there's water left. They have the Bermuda Championship. The wind was coming off the ocean. I hit an 8-iron that went 50 yards right. I had 50 yards into the wind wall with water over it. And I hit a lob wedge. I hit a 100-yard shot to 50 yards. It was the best par of my life. It just hit the wall. It was incredible. But to show, like, the wind was gusting like 30, 40 plus that day. I have a video of it. The pin was touching the ground. It bent over so much. It was wild. So that's what that speed looks and feels like.
I would just tell everybody, John, I would say this. If you're playing in a high wind environment on that particular day, embrace the challenge, throw the scorecard away, and just try to have some fun and see if you can hit some cool shots. You're not going to be able to score anywhere near what you normally would. Have some fun with it. It's fun.
I like the challenge of it. Here's a broader question for you. When I first started following, you were one of the first, literally the first people I followed when I started Practical Golf. And I always thought you had one of the coolest catchphrases. I'll read it here for people. This is from Andrew's Twitter or X profile, at Andrew Rice Golf. This is like your kind of like your moniker. You're saying, what is essential to the golf swing and what is merely a matter of style? I always like that about you. Can you just talk to me a little bit about that and your philosophy on the golf swing and coaching?
John, I wrote a book. The title of the book was It's All About Impact in 2009. I started to look at so many different golf swings. Part of the theme behind the book was I took the top 25 players, male, female, of all time, and I decided I'm going to study each of their golf swings and try to find what's consistent. What matches in all of these 25 swings? And I started to get a sense that the look of the golf swing wasn't really what it's all about. And I know for the first, now I would say 50% of my teaching career, most of my teaching was based on how it looked. I shudder to think what would have happened if DJ had come to me for a lesson back in the early days, or Jim Furyk had come to me for a lesson back in the early days, because I definitely would have done all I could to make them look more traditional. And certainly with the swings we've seen, and we've come a long way over the last 20 years, our understanding has broadened, has improved, and it's not so much about how a swing looks. It's not so much about the style of the golf swing. If it was, Adam Scott would be a world beater. It's far more about getting that golf ball to sizzle off the club face. I was fortunate to teach quite a few years ago. I was teaching a player by the name of Cliff Kresge, and he was in one of the final groups at Harbortown on Sunday. And I was standing on the range with him. Anthony Kim was still playing back in those days.
Oh, man.
Hitting balls on the range. We had Boo Weekly. We had Jim Furyk. We had Aaron Baddeley. And I know I'm leaving one or two others out, but very, very different swings. And the thing that struck me was the sound and the flight of their golf balls all looked the same. All looked the same. Like the ground shook when they hit that 6 or 7 iron. You could feel it in your feet, and it was beautiful to see. But it really opened my eyes to the fact that it's not so much about how your golf swing looks. And I think so many people who follow, there's some great follows on Twitter and on Instagram at the moment. I think golfers are slowly but surely starting to get over the way it looks. I think golfers at the front of the line are starting to get over it. There's a lot of golfers behind them who are still trying to make it look a certain way. I would encourage people to get your ball to look and sound a certain way. And once you've got that, who cares?
So then what does matter to you the most now?
Certainly impact matters. How the face, I would say it this way. This is something I've been thinking about a lot. How the face is positioned in the early part of the downswing. To me, I could really, if I could pick these three things, I would go club face angle in the early downswing, club head location in the early downswing, and potential for speed. And I think if you can tick 1, 2, 3 of those boxes, you're pretty good. You can get the ball to sizzle off the face in a repeatable fashion, and it's going to go far enough to where you can compete with just about anybody. Face angle, early. Club head location, and people often talk about steep and shallow in the downswing, but really, if we're referencing where the club head is, no one ever says, well, my hands are too far out. Well, if your hands get too far out and the club head's well behind you, then the shaft is very shallow and a lot of people are going to be happy. It's oftentimes more about the club head location in the early part of the downswing. If that's good, now you have incentive to go ahead and rotate more, to pivot your body, to get into that front side, to lean the shaft, to de-loft the club face and put some energy into the back of the golf ball.
Definitely something I look at as well, that transition period or post-transition where the lead arm is parallel to the ground in the downswing. You know, I look for similar things. What's the club face doing? What are the wrist angles? What's the shaft pitch or club head location? But also things like where's their weight position? You know, most amateurs are still kind of on their back foot mm-hmm. by that point, whereas you see yeah. most professionals are fully, they're already into their left side by that point, which relates obviously to things like ground contact. Even myself, who would be classed as, or at least some people class me as a non-technical teacher, that's certainly something that I look at when working with swing mechanics.
We are going to take a quick break and we will be right back.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/sweetspot. LinkedIn is not just a job board. It helps you hire professionals you cannot find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job, but might be open to a new perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. Also on LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. Just recently, they even launched a new feature that helps you write your job description, making the process even easier and quicker. And they know that small business owners like myself and Adam are wearing so many hats and might not have the resources to hire, so it's a great place to get help. Now here's what you can do. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/sweetspot. That's linkedin.com/sweetspot to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, it's got to be. And I would, the way you led into this question, John, is what is important? Does it need to look a certain? No, it doesn't need to look a certain way.
Well, that's the thing, is the three things you described obviously have nothing to do with aesthetics. So you can satisfy one, two, three of those things with all different types of backswings, because you're talking about the post-transition, you know, backswing. Yeah. What is your view? Because a lot, like, I have a funky looking backswing and I've gotten a lot of flack for it, but I think I probably do maybe one or two of the things you're talking about fairly well in the downswing. A lot of people get obsessed about takeaways and backswings and how those look, and you know, everything's on plane. How has your philosophy changed on that over the years?
It's really a case of how does your backswing set up to allow you, the unique individual golfer that you are, to position the face, the head in the early downswing. Freddie Couples gets it long and across, and John Rahm gets it short and laid off, and they both get the face and the club head location in a pretty good spot coming down.
Yeah, I always like to think of the players. What do we need more of at impact? And then what are our tools to be able to influence that? It's like, okay, this player is hooking it left. They need a more open face at impact. What can we do to achieve that? Well, we could change the takeaway. We could change that early downswing. We could change the top of the swing. That way you end up getting the functional goal of a different impact and thus different ball flight. But everybody can look different and they can do it in different ways as well. And you can work around physical injuries with that philosophy as well, as opposed to what you and I, Andrew, went through when we first were in the instruction industry, where everybody had to look the same. And, you know, if people couldn't do that, it was like, well, sucks for you. But now we, as instructors, I feel like we have more options available to us. I really want to make the point that that is not a compensation. Right. And I think you would agree with me there that something that veers from a textbook model is not a compensation. It's just a different way of doing it. Right.
Certainly. Certainly. We can make the ball, Ernie Els can make the ball sound and look pretty good. And Victor Hovland can make the ball sound and look pretty good. But their swings have nothing really, I shouldn't say at all in common. Of course they do. But their swings have very, very, very little in common.
What's one thing? We had Frank Nobilo on the show recently, and this is becoming one of my favorite questions to ask people who've kind of gone through. You played at a very high level, I know that, and you've been teaching for a long time. And you were one of the first people to really embrace TrackMan and go head on into that. Like, what's one thing or what sticks out the most pre-TrackMan versus now where you're like, oh God, I can't believe I did that. We often talk about this. The information was technically quote unquote wrong, but Adam, you know, brings up, yeah, but people still figured out how to hit the ball straight. Like, what's one thing where you were like, oh my God, I can't believe I was doing that. And now it's like, oh, the light bulb.
That's an easy one. I would say two things. Number one, I would start with the difference between swing direction and club path. When you take that dry erase marker and you insert the VHS tape into the video recorder and it pops up on the screen, and you take a ruler and you run that dry erase line down the shaft and you show the player the down the line swing and you show them how that club is above the line way too much and they've got to get it closer to the line, because that is your club path and that helps you shape the golf ball. False. And then secondly, the role in this whole physics package of attack angle. Never considered it. Thankfully, now we do.
And it's a shame because we had the geometry. It is just geometry, right? If we just studied it, if we just applied it more to golf, we would have figured this stuff out a long time ago. But you know, even pre-TrackMan, was it the Jorgensen book?
Yes.
I'm going to have to, but that had all the information in there. And that was from, what was it, the 90s or early 2000s?
I think it was before then.
No, Adam, we went through this exercise on a prior episode. I looked
that was Cochran and Stubbs.
Oh, Cochran, I'm sorry.
Cochran and Stubbs was back in the 60s.
Yeah,
and we had a lot of
this. That's right, the 60s is the ball flight law one.
Yeah.
Expand on attack angle. What do you mean by that? What do you think about attack angle before, and what do you think about it now?
There's a graphic that I like to share with a lot of my, I'll call them advanced players. And I go swing direction. So I make a swing with a 7-iron and I swing straight at the target. Okay. We've all seen those PVC hula hoop devices that are back in the woods behind driving ranges that no one uses much anymore. Okay. If you can picture that PVC pipe and you're looking straight down it, that angled circle is aligned straight at the target. That is a swing direction that is straight. I'm going to hit a 7-iron and I'm going to hit a driver. So I swing straight with both clubs. With the 7-iron, I would like to hit 4 degrees down. With a driver, I would prefer to hit 2 or 3 or maybe 4 up. What is the resultant club path with each of those shots? And with an iron, a 7-iron, I'm approximately 3 degrees from in to out. I'm going to get typically a shot that starts as a right-hander a little to the right of the target and curves nicely back to the target. With a driver, I'm going to get, if I'm hitting 4 up on the ball, I'm going to get a club path of 4 out to in. I'm going to hit shots that start left and work back to the fairway, that fade back to the fairway. But I've made 2 straight swings. And that is the role, John, of attack angle and how attack angle can really change what the golf ball is experiencing. We're using this utensil to give the golf ball its marching orders, and we need to understand how this utensil communicates with the golf ball. TrackMan helped me tremendously with that.
Yeah, so in order to keep a club path square for different clubs, we actually have to swing in different directions. With a driver, we have to swing more to the right if we're hitting up on it. With an iron, we have to swing more to the left if we're hitting down on it, which we should be, or if the club is moving down through impact. I don't like hitting down as a term.
Yes.
I remember sitting down with Kevin Smeltz. I know you know him, when we were doing the Ledbetter training and we first had the TrackMan. And all of us at that point, we had this swing direction number and this swing path number. And we're all like, well, what's the difference then? Why are they different numbers? Because this is showing 3 on this and this is showing 5 on this. How can they possibly be different? I think we had to phone one of the reps of TrackMan to have it explained to us. And we were still like, I still don't get it.
My but, TrackMan's broken.
Yeah. But after a few months of thought, we got it.
Adam and I did an episode on swing direction, and Adam obviously understands this stuff way better than me. Is it fair to say is that what the naked eye observes is swing direction and not, you know, that's what they got wrong? They were looking at swing direction on camera and they didn't understand path.
I think that's a fair statement, John. Yep. We observed that in 2D, and it certainly depended on where your camera was located and the angles you created by the position of your tripod back there. But we used that as this is what the golf ball's experiencing. And really, that's like the universe. It's which piece of the universe do we use to strike the golf ball? When the club head's traveling down, the resultant path is in to out. When the club head's traveling up on a straight swing, the resultant path is out to in.
Yeah, things like divot direction don't necessarily show the path, you know, what the ball is experiencing during impact and what happens to the club after impact. You can have a divot that points left. Yeah, you can have that ball start slightly right and even draw.
Correct.
Yeah, I've seen that a few times. And even with that, you can then go into gear effect, which, you know, TrackMan helped to popularize. The gear effect existed before TrackMan. I remember my physics lecturer in university in 2001 talking about gear effect. And that was mind-blowing for me then. But then, you know, 2008, 2009 started to become more popular, that idea. But yeah, I remember seeing a player, a friend of mine, hit with a divot that was pointing almost 45 degrees left, yet his ball started right and drew. At first, it's like, how on earth does that happen? But it makes sense when you think, well, it was a toe shot, so he got toe gearing.
Yeah.
His path and his swing direction or divot direction are not exactly the same. So yeah, having these devices to measure these things takes away a lot of that mystery of, you know, divot reading or tea leaf reading.
Yes, well said.
You talked about face control earlier, and that's one of our, we always talk about face control on the show. I just think it's, you know, we talk about strike location and ground contact, but as you get better at this game, like, I think the PGA Tour is essentially a measure of face control.
Well said.
Whoever has the best face control that week and putts well, like, is going to win. But obviously, normal golfers, everyday golfers, they're struggling with big misses, excessive curvature, because they're having a hard time controlling the face. What are some of the things that you give to your students or even people who follow you online? It's like, how can I control my face better? Is there a simple, I know it could get very advanced, but what are your thoughts on the players who really struggle? It's like way too open, way too close, big blocks, big hook.
This is the topic that makes the golf instruction world go around. It is why I have the ability to sleep in a house instead of a tent. It's because golfers have a hard time with this, and we will always have a hard time with this because it's not easy.
It's like the most variable thing there is.
For sure. The way I look at it is this. I've done quite a bit of testing personally and on other golfers, and I believe that when a player steps up to a golf ball, their instinctive sense is that they don't necessarily, their priority is not to make the ball go far. Their priority is not to make the ball go in the air. Their priority is to make the ball go to the target. And so once a player has a hugely open face in the downswing, they're going to do all they can with their body and their athleticism, their skill set, to get that toe around, to get that face not open. And they better hurry up because they don't have a lot of time.
And so time is running
out. The weight stays back. The handle stays back. The path gets way to the left because all of those factors enable this very open face golfer to get the face around, and they go, see that? I can do it. I can hit that ball straight. The problem is, can you do it again? And can you do it again? That's where this notion that all golfers are talking about, consistency, comes from. It's very difficult when you've got a lot of work to do in a very short window of time to be consistent with that. Opposite end of the spectrum, a shut face coming down. They've got a really strong grip. They're not aware, but the face is really closed. They drive their hips forward massively. They swing way out to the right. They've never taken a divot post-golf ball ever, and they can most often pick this golf ball off the surface. It starts 7 degrees to the right and has this violent hook and comes back and finishes on the green. And they go, see, I can do it. What are they doing? The shut face golfer is doing everything they possibly can. They athletically can, in that tenth of a second on the way down, to slow the face. Let's understand, the face on the way down is always closing. Just the nature of rotation. As I turn my body, the club face is always going to be rotating, okay, just because I'm turning. The shut face golfer is doing all they can to slow that closure down. And that's why they get their hands forward. That's why they get their weight way forward. That's why they swing way out to the right, so that they can hold off that strong face and give themselves an opportunity to not necessarily strike the ball well, but start it out to the right and hook it back. The strongly open face golfer on the way down is doing the exact same thing, just the opposite set. They're swinging way left, handle back, toe comes around, and neither of them are going to be able to strike the ball with any degree of consistency. They are going to have a greater ability to be consistent with certainly where they launch the golf ball, but also how they shape the golf ball. But none of that is any kind of championship level of face control. And so what do they need? They need to get the face in an appropriate location early so that they have less work to do, less compensating, less countering on the way down, and they can go ahead and rotate. One of the big things, we all see it, right? It's there. It's not every single great player, but almost every single good player, when you view them from down the line at impact, has their hips, their body more pivoted than almost every single 16 handicapper that I've ever seen. Why is that? Because the face is in place and they can go ahead and rotate. And now they have this hyper ability to control the face that much better. Nothing is perfect. Nothing is guaranteed, a given. But they have vastly improved ability to manage the face.
We did an episode the other day on what would you do if you could go back in time again and relearn golf. Luckily, most people said they'd have lessons. I think this is an example of, you know, if you don't have those lessons early on, usually in most cases, people start with a weak grip, or, you know, if they're a builder, they're used to using tools, they start with a very strong grip. And then that leads to poor face positions, which leads to us self-organizing negatively all of these, I don't like the word compensations, but bad ways of doing it.
Athletic adaptations.
Those negative adaptations. Yeah, those guys, you know, swinging in to out to keep the face open, try and hook it on the target, they're going to suffer with low point issues, because the more we swing to the right, the more that low point moves back. The guy who's early releasing to try and close the face is going to also suffer with low point issues, because an early release moves the low point back as well, and it increases spin loft. That's why they don't hit it anywhere. So yeah, getting these lessons early on. And you know, I like to start people with a pretty good looking neutral grip. They don't necessarily finish there. You know, we work around that with what they ultimately, how their body moves and their athleticism. But I think for most people, starting with a good grip and working out from there, there's a little bit of movement either side that individuals can have. I don't want people to panic and think, I must have this perfect grip. But yeah, you know.
Exactly.
So what are is it safe to say most of the people who come to your lesson tier are struggling with the open face, early extension, like compensation?
I would say that's the majority of people. And when you have, you said early extension, they also under-rotate. Why? Because when the face gets open, how do we close it? We swing to the left. And we swing to the left by getting the club head out in the downswing, i.e. steep. Okay. If they rotate their body, now they saw this video and they got to rotate coming into impact. If they rotate their body, they get further out. And that's bad.
Yeah.
And so they stand and they stop the rotation. They keep the handle back and do all they can to speed up that toe to get it around. And every now and then they can do it. And it's invariably a pick. They struggle with the strike. They can hit high, short 7-irons where the golf ball is going, hey, nice 9-iron. They always wonder why they don't hit it far enough. I taught two young pros the other day. One chap I taught for the first time, and one was his buddy who I've taught for a number of years, both very, very good golfers. And the one guy had a weakish right-hand grip, and as a result, he had an overly open face. Their club speeds were about the same, but the one kid hit the ball 20 yards longer than the other, purely because the one guy had to slow his body down and dump the face and deliver way too much loft. He was swinging at 94 miles an hour, and he hit the ball 130 to 140 feet in the air with a 7-iron, which is wicked high.
Wow. Wow. If you had to guess, this is the part that fascinates me. So you have multiple people coming to you with the same problem. Now, how many different ways would you estimate that you explain this or different interventions that you use to get the club face closed in this scenario? Like, how many tools are in your toolbox as an instructor, if you had to guess?
A lot.
Because it's not as simple as like, oh, let's strengthen your grip. Let's just close. Like, it's not that simple.
Exactly. Everybody is unique in some capacity. I've taught golfers who've had a really open face on the way down with a very strong grip.
Yeah. So that doesn't make sense to a lot of people. Yeah.
So that's not going to work, right? So you've got to go about it differently, and vice versa. A slightly weak right hand can also work to get the club face very open on the way down. And so everybody's unique and they've got a little different package. Seldom are two golfers going to hear the same message from me. I'm not saying it's not possible. It's possible, certainly. I would also say I wouldn't go, okay, here's my open face package and this is what you need. Although that wouldn't necessarily hurt, but I don't just give people, here's the packet of information, go do this and you'll get better. I suspect they would get better, but I like to try to tailor things to each unique individual.
Well, I think that's a fair thing. Like, you give a lot of information out for free online. You're very generous with what you have tons of YouTube videos. You're involved with the Golf Fanatic. You've been doing stuff for years. And that's, I think, what people, you've communicated this as well. It's like, that's the difference of you giving out information, being like, okay, here's X amount of things that could fix this versus, you know, if you went to Andrew directly in person and pay him his hourly rate, like, you're going to get to the answer a lot faster.
For sure.
That's what instruction is. Like, you're paying for a trained eye to give you customized advice.
We're going to take the guessing away.
Yes. And I think that's the hardest thing for a lot of golfers to even understand is that, you know, it's very simple to assume like, oh, I'm slicing the ball. Let me go look up anti-slice drills. Like, there's a number of drills. You have some of them that are good, but like, is it the right one?
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah. That being said, I really do think if anyone listening in, if you're a high ball flight pull fader, and every now and then you hit a really flush pull, and every now and then you hit a really weak, high, short of the right bunker fade, if you said, okay, I need to go about improving my golf and I'm going to do it this way. First, let's start with the face. Get the face, excluding the address position. I want the face square at address. I don't like that face shot at address. Keep the face square at address. And for every single frame during the course of your swing, you did everything you could to get the face as closed as possible. I think that would be a great starting point. Going up, and even more importantly, coming down, get the face as strong as possible. You wouldn't ever need to think, I'm going to swing the right field ever again, because that instinctive adaptation that we all have within us of, wow, this face is really closed. It feels like as a right-hander, I'm going to hit this way to the left. I think I'm going to start just naturally swinging to the right. And if you actually get the club face changed, the rest of your swing will follow suit.
Yeah, we talk, that's positive self-organization. Yeah, once you get that club face doing what you want, then lots of the symptoms that come with it will fall away, yeah.
Weight shift, shaft lean, swinging into out, it all happens.
On the topic of instruction, I'm sure you work similar to me, and we're actually going to do a podcast on this called Algorithmic Coaching, where, you know, our process is kind of starts from impact. It's like, what do we need to change from impact? Then we look at what are the variables. So, you know, if you're trying to get the club face closed, well, we got wrist angles that we can do. We've got supination at the bottom, which I suppose will come under wrist angles. We've got grip strength as well. So we have these options to be able to close that face. Then looking at that player's swing, you would make the right intervention based on what they need and how it links to other things as well. You know, if that player is hitting high and right and they have a cup lead wrist, you're probably not going to strengthen their grip. You're probably going to change the wrist angles, right? Because it makes more sense. It improves the system as a whole. To John's point, the way that we might convey that message might be different. We might give different analogies. We might give someone more internal, another player more external, and even different parts of the swing, as you were talking about, Andrew. Some players, you might change those wrist angles in a takeaway. Some players, you might change them towards the top or transition. Some players, you might work on it directly through impact and allow the other parts to self-organize as well. So would you agree with that overall kind of structure?
100%. I'm going to start with my TrackMan numbers, which is exactly what you said. That's impact. That is the message the club conveyed to the golf ball and where was the club traveling. And then I'm going to back that up with my experience and go, typically when I see people hitting a half a degree down, swinging with a club path of 9.1 to the left and delivering 31 degrees of loft with the 7-iron, this is happening. And so, okay, we got that. Let's go to the video. Let's go and look at that. We'll look at the video. We'll confirm the face is very open. We need to get this face stronger.
And I'll just throw in a quick word of caution to people. We've done episodes on launch monitors. Essentially, what Adam and Andrew are saying here is that they've worked with hundreds, actually thousands of golfers looking at these devices, seeing the numbers. And a lot of people have access to TrackMan now on the GC Quad. They go to simulator places. Like we often say, don't look at what you don't understand and how these all work together. It's way more, I don't understand it. That's why I don't look at a lot of it either.
That's the advantage of a coach is we can look at a wall of numbers. We instantly can select the right number. And then we can go through that process I've just said. And in a lesson, it comes out as you need to do more of this. You know, we're not giving all that information to everybody. It's just you need to do more of this. Maybe we explain a little bit about why so they're not taking our information at face value. They understand a little bit deeper. But yeah, we simplify the information. We get them there quicker, effectively.
Well, it's like I've probably said this before. It's like when Neo in the Matrix was looking at the Matrix and all he saw was like the abstract part of it. And then he saw it as like, oh, it's like you could see it now, or like a 3D painting, one of those things. If you don't see it, you really don't see it. And then you could probably do more damage than good. So I always like to throw in that disclaimer where it's appropriate.
If I had access, if I was someone who was inexperienced when it came to using launch monitors, I would try to limit myself to club path. What direction is the club head traveling relative to the target at impact? Dynamic loft. I'd get a basic understanding of that with the understanding that the slower your speed, the more loft you should be delivering at impact with that club. Attack angle.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I have a GC3 now, and I don't use it often. I don't put the stickers on it all the time, but I'll check in with my path, the driver and stuff like that, attack angle once in a while, but it's not a huge priority for me.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with that. Keep it to those 2, 3, 4 things. So should we talk about Victor Hovland's wedges now?
You'd like to, John.
Me and Adam were mentioning it beforehand. We keep mentioning, it keeps coming up on this show for some reason, because it's become I don't know if we have enough time for it, but we've talked about wedges on the show and a lot of information has changed over the years. And recently, like I think we mentioned it on the Scott Fawcett episode, it's come up a few times, but your buddy, I know you're friends with Joe Mayo.
Yeah.
He's your buddy.
I love Joe.
But we're seeing there's some recent stuff saying like, oh, let's get super steep, you know, a lot of big angle of attack, like -9, -10, -11 wedges, tons of shaft lean, launching it low and spinning it like crazy. Whereas I think the last 5, 6 years, we've heard a lot of shallow it out, use the bounce. And people are seeing all this stuff on social media. They're like, well, what do I do? I'm searching too. So I'm just curious to get your opinion on it, because I don't think anyone's ever truly right in golf. Like there's multiple ways to skin the cat, as we're talking about with the golf swing. But what's your thought on this? Victor Hovland went from literally the worst, I think it's safe to say he was probably the worst wedge player in pro golf a few years ago, and now he's one of the best. And he's doing some methods that I think a lot of modern wedge teachers have not been advocating for. So what's your best explanation of this whole thing, just to get some info?
John, I would like to start by saying that the job that Joe has done with Victor has been absolutely phenomenal. And I know Victor has made a lot of money due to his upgrades. And I've said this to a number of my students. If you can hit the ball really, really well, then the quality of your short game starts to matter more.
Yeah.
Victor is testament to that. Okay. Then the quality of your short game starts to matter more. Joe has done an incredible job. He's used his mathematical brain and his intellect to really come up with something that works beautifully for Victor. That's not to say it's only going to work for Victor, but my take is this. I've seen some amazing wedgers who can launch it low and they can spin it a lot who don't hit down that much. There are, as with the golf swing, there are multiple ways to get it done. The quest for us as golfers, the quest for us as coaches is we've got to find something that works for the person in front of us. I am of the opinion that when we're looking at the top tier of the game, the ability to control trajectory, the ability to control spin is paramount. The level of golfer that I deal with on a daily basis is looking to make pretty standard contact. If I can get the ball like not thin and not fat, life is good.
Yeah.
And it's not so much about being able to launch it at 28 and spin it at 7,500 from a set distance. It's more, can I get the ball on the face? And I am of the opinion that, and we saw this years ago, right? We all know the old chipping technique. Get the ball back, get your weight and hands forward, and chop down on the thing. Okay? Well, we spent a long time trying to get people out of that, and I think we've done a pretty good job. This is not, and Joe is certainly not advocating that, but the message that golfers could easily take from Joe is that I need to hit down a lot. I need to hit down a lot. And in my estimation, when an 18 handicapper hits down a lot, he's going to be able to do that. But his ability, his or her ability to be able to regulate where that club bottoms out is not quite to the level that Victor's is.
Well, yeah, I guess that's what I've been vocal about my search for better greenside wedge play as well. And that's what I was wondering is like, Victor obviously has otherworldly skill. He can make these adjustments and it might have been appropriate for him. I got some numbers from one of the best wedge players in the world. Here are his numbers. This was on a 17 and a half yard carry. Launch was 35, attack angle was 4.5. I don't have dynamic loft, spin rate's 5,200. So, you know, not as down
as. Spin is high.
Yeah. So a little higher launch, a little less steep because, you know, Victor was at what, 10, 11 down, 27 launch, higher spin.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just interesting to me. I'm just, you know, again, a lot of golfers see this and people are going to be experimenting it on their own. So what do you think is the answer? Again, we always cater to the average player. Like what's their path of least resistance to hitting good, crisper wedge shots? That's the thing is like you said, low point control, ground contact. Like that's the thing we all struggle with.
That is the name of the game, John. And I really believe if the average everyday golfer could grasp that and understand that, if you just scrape a skinny little line on the ground and you set up with the leading edge of your wedge on that line, and you make 10 swings and you get that baby to bottom out on the very front side of that line all 10 times, you're in good shape. You're in good shape. Let's also understand that we can have shaft lean and still employ the bounce. If the shaft is leaning forward 20 degrees, but I've opened the face, I've added 10 degrees of loft, I've really beefed up the bounce and I can still use the bounce and it's not going to dig.
That's how I do it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so you can have shaft lean, you can hit down, you can still use the bounce. It's just a question of the margin of error. Does it get skinnier or broader with that sharp angle of attack? And my take is that I think it gets a little skinnier for the average everyday golfer. I would love to see golfers give me somewhere between 4 and 8 down on short gamey type shots, chips, pitches, that kind of stuff. Give me somewhere there. I think you give yourself a good opportunity to put the face on the back of the golf ball, get some ground contact post that impact without too many bad things happening.
I'll weigh in a little here because I've actually been talking to Joe a little as well.
We're going to try and get Joe on the show soon just because, again, it's interesting to me. I want to talk to Joe about a lot of things, but we'll try and get him on.
It's not really talked about arc depth much. We all talk about low point. Sometimes we link or we put the two together. Low point is arc depth and low point position. But I kind of separate them out. So for the listeners, if you're to visualize this, thinking of a hula hoop, the low point position is the lowest point on that hula hoop. So you can move that forwards and back. But there's also the depth part, that depth component. You could drop that hula hoop deeper into the ground or shallower. And so, you know, even in terms of how we place golfers into buckets, you know, we've talked about picking it clean versus hitting down on it. Well, what I think Joe has done with Victor is he's got him to hit down with a steep angle of attack by getting the low point of the swing forwards. But he's also got him to work his body up through impact, which I know you agree with. I know you've posted about that before as well, Andrew. Yeah. So getting the body to work up. And that avoids the club digging in too much. So you're able to get this steeper angle of attack without digging in too much as well. Now, whether this is easier or more difficult for the regular golfer, I think there's lots of components that go into that. But something you also said, Andrew, is about margin for error, I think you used, or, you know, do you have a little buffer either side, you know, because there's skill, how much you can repeat something, but also if you're a little bit off, can you get away with it? And for some people, I think what we're trading off here is bounce or increased bounce. That gives us a margin for error, because if you have bounce on the club, and you hit the ground early, it's not going to dig in as much. Lots of the debris is going to get shuttled underneath the bounce. So for some people, that might be a more optimal safety net. Whereas what I was talking about with Joe the other day is about how when we lean the club shaft forwards and reduce the loft of a club, you actually start to strike higher up on the face, a few degrees higher up on the face for the same club face presentation. So if you think about it, if the club was laying back flat 60, 70, even 80 degrees of loft, you're always going to strike the bottom grooves. Whereas as you lean the face forwards a little bit more and de-loft it, you strike higher up on the face. And so when we strike higher up on the face, that gives us a little bit more up and down movement or margin for error. Because now we can drop a tiny bit lower and the bounce is not hitting the ground first, as long as we don't dig too much like Hovland's doing. And we can also go a little bit higher up before it becomes a bladed shot. Now, to put all that information into something someone could understand, this is why your 60 degree is usually more difficult to strike and you suffer with fats and blades. It's usually more that reason than with a 52 degree wedge, which feels a little easier. So, and this is a lot to understand in a podcast format, so hopefully some of that made sense to people. But yeah, there's two different safety nets there. You've got the Hovland method, which is giving more arc depth variance before it becomes a bad shot. And you've got a method which includes more bounce, which has been more popular recently, which means you can hit the ground in the wrong place and get away with it more. And I don't know the answer to which one that is, but my theory is the battle in the industry at the moment between the let's use loads of bounce and let's lean it forward. I think the battle is, it's one of those situations where both are right, just might mean different for different situations, depending on different turf conditions, perhaps.
I would say this, if you're a golfer listening in and you're looking to take something away from this, if you're chipping or pitching, in the backswing, get forward, in the downswing, stay tall. Get forward and stay tall and do what you can to get those crispy strikes.
Yeah.
Just there's technical side and there's a skill side. You can work on both at the same time.
I'd agree with you, Andrew. In the technical aspect, the consistent theme between those two different camps would be getting forward, working up through impact. At least that's what I'd hope. And then from the skill side, can you brush the grass in the right area? You know, and if anybody's just to go out and do anything, it's spray a line on the ground to make sure that club is bottoming out on that line without digging excessively, right?
Yeah. If you can do that, you're going to have more joy around the greens for sure.
That was great. Thank you. Thank you to the both of you, because I don't understand that stuff well enough to have an opinion.
Well, John, I'll have it in my... I'm doing a module in Next Level Golf this month on it, so I'll give you access to that.
Perfect.
But only if you're nice to him, eh, John?
Yeah. We'll let you go soon, Andrew, but you also have a lot of great ideas on practice in general, not too dissimilar to the ideas Adam and I believe in. But, you know, for the golfers who don't have access to an instructor like you, what are some of your bread and butter, golfer at it alone, at the range or at home, practicing on their own? What's your plea to those golfers in the way that they practice?
Okay, I'll try to give you the 2-minute condensed version here, John. Firstly, I would say that block practice is not a bad thing. Repetition is not a bad thing. We need that. We need to be able to take ownership of upgrades, ownership of changes, ownership of feels. And how do we do that? We do that often. I think that's true for every walk of life, whether it's driving a car or delivering the mail. The more practice we have at it, the better we're going to get with it. I would also say this, and this is something I came up with a number of years ago, where I felt that far too often, avid golfers were practicing almost solely in a block practice type mode. And this is where block practice got all its bad vibes and bad press, so to speak, is I encourage my students to look at practice three ways: swing, skill, shot. And if you're going out to practice, ask yourself, am I working on my swing? Am I developing my skill? Or am I hitting a shot? And I would encourage everybody out there to really be quite specific and have some solid lines between each of those three genres of practice. I encourage people, start off with, if you're going to go to the range for 30 minutes, start off with 10 minutes of working on your swing. Please do go for it. Grab a 7 or an 8 iron, put a ball on a tee, give yourself good lies, and make lots of rehearsals of what you're trying to take ownership of. Follow that up with more of an outside the lines skill development session where you're going to go a low, a high, a toe, a heel, an eyes open, an eyes closed, a left leg only, a right hand only, and jump outside the lines and think of yourself as if you're a 14-year-old crazy boy and you're there with your two best buddies and there's no adult supervision. You're having some fun and you're going, dude, check this out. Watch what I can do. And you're just practicing outside the lines. You're developing your ability to manage and control your golf ball. Good golf is when the ball matches the picture in your head. And that's exactly what you're doing in your skill genre of practice. The closing session, we've got to be prepared to do battle on the battlefield in the manner in which we need to do battle. We're going to hit shots. And so I would go that target in the back left of the range, take your 7-iron and try to hit it 20 feet to the right of it with a routine, and you're going to go through the whole deal. The target in the mid right side of the range, you're going to take that same 7-iron and try to hit it 20 feet to the left of that target. Put the 7-iron away. Routine, everything involved. Driver, I'm going to try to go between those two flags out the back left. I'm going to go between those two targets down the right side. Then you hit 2 9-irons. Then you hit 2 hybrids. All with an on-course type mindset, pre-shot routine, the full treatment. And other than the driver where you're trying to go between two targets, instead of hitting at flags or at targets on the range, when you're in shot mode, I would encourage everybody to try to hit slightly to the side, an intentional side of your target. One to the left with a club, one to the right with a club. And that way you've blended those swings, that mechanical, technical stuff, that skill development where you can actually control your golf ball and perhaps control your club face a little bit better. And you've put it into this package that you can take to the battlefield. And you're that much better prepared to be able to go out there and actually perform on the golf course. Swing, skill, shot.
Package it up and sell it. Beautifully said. My highest compliment I can give to someone in golf coaching instruction is someone's a great communicator. I always say Andrew Rice is one of the best communicators in the golf industry. What you just said for the last 2 minutes or whatever that was love it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I really do appreciate that. Thank you.
I think coaching is finding different ways to explore a topic. I think the way you just described it was awesome. So I don't have anything to add to that. Adam, do you have other questions for Andrew that we didn't call? I'm sure we can go on forever here, obviously, but
not just talking about what Andrew just said about the technical skill and play. I mean, those are big things that we focus on as well. I'm more in the technical side of it being a coach, but I've also, you know, with the practice manual as well, talked a lot about skill. I've pushed that very hard because I think it's not something that's talked about enough in the golf industry. Skills of being able to hit different parts of the face, being able to just hit the ball more right or more left in specific amounts as well. If you can do that on the range when you're playing by feel on the golf course, it makes it much easier to hit straight shots because If you're like me and John, when we're practicing, we see a ball go left, we say to ourselves, well, let's hit the next one a little bit more right. You know, and we have multiple ways of doing that, but most of them are feel-based. So it's not that difficult. Ball went left, let's make the next one go right. And it's that constant game. Okay, I've overdone it, underdone it. All right, now I found it. Let's hold on to that feeling for as long as possible. But most golfers will hit it left and then they'll just continue doing that for 100 times in a row and think it's broken because they don't know what it feels like to hit the right side of the spectrum. Or they'll shank one and then, you know, the day is over because they don't know, they've never explored what it takes to hit it off the toe of the club. And so, you know, adding these things in your practice are very important.
One of my favorite fun challenges, if you do have access to some kind of a launch monitor, is I call it the curve challenge. See how many shots you can hit where your first shot is, take a 7-iron, put it on a tee if you want. Your first shot has as much curve as possible. And how many shots can you hit that curve consecutively less, incrementally less than that first one? And so 45 degrees of spin axis tilt left, 39, 30, 22. And that's really a great little exercise for golfers to start to get a sense of just controlling the golf ball, controlling the face, so much more than controlling the golf ball, but the factors that go into making that ball do what we want. Trajectory is another one you can do. Start as low as possible and try to, how many shots can you hit that go higher, one shot after another? Those are speed, swing speed. Those are great little challenges that I like to give some of my long-term students.
Yeah, even strike-based drills as well. So, you know, you might start with a beginner, hit 10 shots off the toe for me with a putting swing, you know, relatively easy even for a beginner. And then by the time you get up to the challenge that I personally do is, can I hit it 0 to 5 millimeters off the toe, then 0 to 5 millimeters off the heel, and then bounce around between those and give myself points, turn it into a game as well, which increases engagement. So yeah, there's all these different drills you can do and you can scale them up or down depending on the level that you are. It's really fun.
Guys, I got to tell you, I love the message that you put out. I played with a golfer in Cape Town, South Africa a couple of years ago. He said to me, he's like, you know, I've spent the last few years really working on my mechanics. And he said, I've just pretty much had enough. And I've committed to Adam Young and John Sherman, and I'm just going to go about improving my golf game based on what they say. And I love it. And it's not that, Adam, you've said it a few times, it's not that you're not technical, but there's so many other ways for golfers to get better other than shallowing the club or turning more coming into impact. Let's embrace that other stuff. And I think you'd be amazed as to what happens with your golf swing along the journey. So keep it up, guys. You really are doing a great service to the golf community. I love it. I'm hearing your names more and more and more. Keep it up, eh?
Appreciate that. Well, I think we did a great job. We got through a ton of topics. We hit our numbers in terms of time. So as always with guests, we want you to plug your stuff. So, Andrew, where can everyone find all of your resources online and also your in-person stuff?
Thank you, John. I do want to mention we do have something for coaches coming up in just under a month from now, 4 weeks from now, at Sea Island, November 6th and 7th. We have an event we've been hosting for a number of years now called Coach Camp. And it's pretty much 2 days where coaches, if you're a golfer and you want to come and you're going to hear some stuff to make your head spin, but that's part of the deal. You're welcome to come as well if you're a golfer. 2 days of amazing presentations and sharing dinners. We go deep during the dinners pretty much. That's where all the fun stuff happens. We had a great one with Mike Adams and James Lights, Mark Blackburn and myself last year. We're going to do the same this year. Our presenters are Mike Bender, former PGA Teacher of the Year, Zach Johnson's longtime coach. We've got Jason Bale, who did a tremendous job this year in helping Lucas Glover get back into the winner's circle on multiple occasions, and the coach of the Champion Golfer of the Year, Justin Parsons, Brian Harman's coach. Obviously, we've got the Ping engineers who are going to share some cool stuff. Chris Brody's going to be there. Dr. Sasha McKenzie is coming. And so it's really 2 jam-packed days where coaches can come out and really pick up some great nuggets to help their students play that much better. The information for that is www.coachcampusa.com. coachcampusa.com. If you just follow me and you look up, I'm going to be posting a bunch of links and all that kind of stuff to Coach Camp, but we'd love to see you there. And then if anyone wants to track me down, my website is andrewricegolf.com, Andrew Rice Golf on Insta, Andrew Rice Golf on Twitter. I love both of them. I find I go through phases. I'm currently in a bit of a Twitter phase where I enjoy Twitter and sharing some good stuff, really trying to put good information out on all platforms, but mostly those two.
Awesome. Well, I know you've been doing Coach Camp for a really long time, and I've seen insanely good testimonials for years on it. So yes, thank you again for sharing your knowledge. I feel bad it's been so long that you came back on the show. I feel like we could do 20 more episodes with you. So we'll definitely have you back on again. So thank you.
I'd love to be back, guys. Thanks very much, Adam. John, thanks for all you do, and appreciate the opportunity.
Adam, where can everyone find your stuff?
AdamYoungGolf.com. If you go to Next Level Golf, the product, I'll be talking this month about the wedges that we talked about. So leaning versus bounce and the difference between those, the advantages of each of those. And on the terms of swing direction versus path, I already have modules in there called Plate Golf, where I use a dinner plate to explain all these things between swing direction, path, angle of attack, and how they all relate. So it's a good way of getting some visuals to the things that we talked about. John, where can people find you?
You can check out The Four Foundations of Golf, available on Amazon. And yeah, that's about it for me for now. Appreciate everyone tuning in. Appreciate your feedback, your support, and we will see you soon with a new episode.